Local News, Culture, and NPR.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Garnet Health announces layoffs at its Catskill facilities as part of a restructuring plan. The plan also includes changes to its inpatient palliative care services. We speak to Garnet Health CEO Jonathan Schiller about what this means for the community. After a six-year hiatus, BioBlitz returns to Northeast Pennsylvania for 24 hours of species spotting. Radio Catskill's Joe Johnson has more. In April 22, New York State passed an ambitious mandate. By 2027, all school districts can only purchase zero-emission buses. Radio Catskill reporter Chia Tien Nicole Chen speaks to the superintendent of the Monticello Central School District about how that's going, plus growing older together with Tommy Cambridge. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The founder of online whistleblowing site WikiLeaks has returned home to Australia. Julian Assange has ended years of legal proceedings and imprisonment after publishing classified U.S. documents. Assange flew into Australia's capital, Canberra, today, from where Scott Maiman reports.
In the words of Assange's wife, Stella,
"Today we celebrate because today Julian is free."
After stepping off the plane at Canberra Airport and pumping his fist in the air, Assange's wife explained they need privacy.
"What he's been through, he needs time. He needs to recuperate."
In a plea deal just hours earlier, Assange pleaded guilty to publishing secret information in exchange for no more jail time. Assange's U.S. lawyer, Barry Pollack.
"Hopefully this is the end, not just of the case against Assange, but the end of the case against journalism."
For NPR News, I'm Scott Maiman in Canberra, Australia.
In the U.S., voters went to the polls for primary elections yesterday in Colorado, New York, and Utah. In New York, incumbent Democratic Congressman Jamal Bowman lost to challenger George Latimer. Bowman is critical of Israel in the war against Hamas in Gaza. Latimer won support from pro-Israeli groups. In Colorado, Republican Congresswoman Lauren Boebert won the GOP primary in a district that's not originally her own. She switched districts and ran again for office. And in Utah, Republican Congressman John Curtis won the state's GOP Senate primary. From member station KUER, Sage Miller reports he is looking to succeed Senator Mitt Romney.
Curtis beat three other candidates, including one who was endorsed by former President Donald Trump. At his watch party, Curtis refuted claims that he is similar to Mitt Romney.
"If you expect me to be Mitt Romney, I'm going to disappoint you."
The election results seem to affirm that Republican voters in Utah aren't cozying up to Trump. While voting with Trump more than 90% of the time, Curtis is viewed as a moderate conservative. For NPR News, I'm Sage Miller in Salt Lake City.
Stocks open mixed this morning as Volkswagen makes a big bet on an electric truck maker. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 130 points in early trading.
VW plans to invest at least $1 billion and perhaps as much as $5 billion in a joint venture with Rivian. Stock in the electric truck maker soared on the news. The company said they want to work together on best-in-class EV software. Crude oil prices are climbing, along with retail gasoline prices in the U.S. AAA finds the average price of regular gasoline has jumped about a nickel a gallon in the last week. It's still about 10 cents a gallon lower, though, than it was a month ago. FedEx stock opened higher after the delivery company projected better-than-expected profits for the year. Stock in Southwest Airlines hit some turbulence, though. Southwest lowered its forecast for quarterly revenue, saying demand for air travel has been uneven. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. A human rights group in Kenya says at least 22 people have died in the country following this week's protests against new tax increases. Police opened fire on protesters in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. Demonstrators say they were protesting peacefully and police attacked them. Kenyan officials say the demonstrators became violent. The Biden administration will hand out new grants to places trying to build more affordable housing. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports the skyrocketing cost of housing is a major concern for voters.
The money, $185 million in all, is to help places overcome barriers or delays to expanding low-income housing. For example, Denver needs more utility and electric lines downtown. Other places will use it for things like cost overruns or to rewrite zoning laws. Vice President Kamala Harris announced the grants a day after Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen touted new financing for affordable housing. Many voters are sour on Biden because of spiking rents and mortgages, although the core problem, a severe housing shortage, will take years to fix. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
A judge in Michigan has blocked state rules on abortion access. The judge has temporarily blocked Michigan's 24-hour waiting period before a patient can seek an abortion. And it blocks the state's requirement that only a doctor can perform the procedure. The state judge says these provisions conflict with a constitutional amendment that Michigan voters approved nearly 2 years ago. A legal challenge is ongoing. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Schwab, with Schwab investing themes like artificial intelligence, renewable energy, or pet passion. Over 40 themes to invest in. Learn more at schwab.com. And the Doris Duke Foundation.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll learn more about the Garnet Health restructuring plan in just a moment. But first, the primary results from New York yesterday. Lou Ingrassia bested Camille O'Brien Tuesday night in the Republican primary in the 100th Assembly District by a margin of approximately 1,249 votes to 858. New York 100 consists of Sullivan County and Middletown and Wallkill in Orange County. Ingrassia will face Democrat Paula Kaye in November's general election. The seat had been held by Democrat Aileen Gunther for more than two decades. She's retiring at the end of the year. Incumbent Sarahana Srista won her Democratic primary in the 103rd Assembly District against challenger Gabby Madden by an unofficial margin of 8,928 votes to 4,549 votes, excuse me. The district comprises mainly Ulster County and a small part of Dutchess County. Srista will now face Republican Jack Hayes in November's general election. And two Democrats vying in Tuesday's primary in New York State Assembly District 102, Janet Tweed of Delhi and Mary Finneran of Cairo. Their race is still too close to call, with Tweed leading Finneran right now, 51% to 49% for Finneran, with 95% of precincts reporting. Now, Garnet Health recently announced a restructuring plan that will affect 26 employees, less than 1% of its workforce. This restructuring is expected to save approximately $4.6 million in salaries and benefits, according to Garnet Health. As part of the restructuring, inpatient palliative care services will no longer be provided. Additionally, Garnet Health plans to optimize its infectious disease practice to better meet the needs of inpatients, they say. Radio Catskills' Patricio Rubio spoke to Jonathan Schiller, president and CEO of Garnet Health, to discuss what these changes mean for the community.
So we can go over the what and the why for three different services and then talk a little bit about additional changes. But the three services that we have here, inpatient palliative care, it's a consult service that's restricted to inpatient only and at the Middletown campus. And this is a specialty that's works with patients and their families when patients are nearing end of life. And so the service for us is a wonderful service for patients. However, it's not one that we're able to afford to continue. The hospital does have to subsidize the service each year, and we're just unable to make that subsidy going forward. The Garnet Health Doctors does run an infectious disease service, and we're so fortunate to have talented providers in that service. So early this year, we expanded our outpatient clinic hours to provide additional services to the community. And what we found was that for those services and those additional hours we had created, there was not enough demand from the community to fill the schedules. And so we had, clinicians or doctors and nurse practitioners working hard but not seeing patients because there was empty schedules. And so what we're doing is contracting those outpatient schedules to more closely align with demand. And so that is the change there. And I suppose when you think about it, it's a good thing that the community doesn't need that much infectious disease coverage. However, still, it's a change for us and that we're seeing there. And then the last is we do have and have had for a number of years medical directorship and health services agreements with three of the local nursing homes in Orange County. And again, a service that has three great providers in it. However, that the hospital does subsidize that service every year, and we're just unable to afford continuing subsidizing that service any longer. So we're working with the nursing homes that are impacted, and we'll phase those services out throughout between now and the end of the year. So those are kind of the bigger things. And we also did have, as part of our restructuring, some non-clinical areas that, you know, where we had some middle management positions that were also eliminated.
You're saying that the palliative care mainly affects the Middletown campus?
That's correct. The palliative care service primarily covers the Middletown inpatient only.
So where will folks be able to get this type of care now that Garnett is no longer offering it?
Sure. Palliative care is really a subspecialty within internal medicine, and all of our hospitalists on the internal medicine service or the hospitalist service do have palliative care training, although they're not specialists. And so for the core of some of the clinical work that the palliative care doctors did, such as managing patients' pain or special, what we refer to as IVs or drips, they're able to provide that service to our patients.
You mentioned a little bit about the infectious disease practice, that you optimize the infectious disease practice, and that's exactly what you're doing, right?
Yeah, we just had too much. You know, we built it in terms of excess capacity, and it just didn't turn out that the community needed that service.
Are you still committed to the Harris Catskill facility?
Oh, my goodness. The short answer is yes, but I'll expand on that. So, Patricia, you may be aware I was the CEO for our Garnet Health Medical Center Catskills campuses in Harris and Calicoon for 5 years, have a deep commitment to the community. You know, our hospitals are in Sullivan County are critical access and safety net hospitals and are critical to the community. We have every intention of continuing to provide those services for generations and work very closely with New York State and our elected representatives to make sure that we have all of the funding we need for those services. I probably should mention that the announcement that came out yesterday and the activities associated with it had a very minimal impact on our Catskills facilities.
Jonathan, anything else that we have not touched on you want folks to know about this move that's happening at Garnet Health?
Sure. I'll just talk for 1 second about, you know, what's happening in the industry. Certainly, this is a very challenging time for healthcare. It's probably not a good thing that our industry is on the news every night because we're all seeing the increases in costs for pharmaceuticals, medications, supplies, devices, and things that people don't think about for hospitals. You know, we have tremendous consumption of things like fuel and radioactive materials for testing. So there's just so much that goes into running a hospital these days, and the costs that have gone up through general inflation as well as what I'll call medical inflation have really made it more challenging than ever. And so this is part of what we're doing here is doing our best to ensure the long-term sustainability of our health system and all the services that we have.
How much has the pandemic affected the hospital?
It's interesting. The after effect, there's a couple of things that are really concerning to us. One is really in our experience, and just to be clear, I've been in this health system and in this organization for 20 years now. I have never seen the demand for behavioral health or psychiatric services that we're seeing now. We are routinely experiencing a demand beyond the capacity with which we have for the inpatient service and the outpatient service as well. And that's as if that weren't really sad enough. What we're seeing, the youth mental health, the patients that we see coming into our emergency department in a psychiatric crisis are getting younger and younger. And that, although we did see some of that before the pandemic, it certainly is significantly more pronounced now than it had been then. That's one thing that's concerning to us and really has, we believe, been a direct result of the pandemic and all the after effects that it had on us. And another one that sort of is part of a sign of the times, if you will, I guess these days, is all of the pressure on salaries and wages. And so we are experiencing those pressures here, and the salaries and wages that we're paying to remain competitive with not just our industry, but the market for many of our entry level positions is much higher than we would have anticipated. And so that puts a little bit of pressure on the rest of the institution as well.
If folks want to get more information about what's going on, where can they go?
I would say the best place to go is the GarnetHealth.org website. We do our best to keep all of our content timely and refreshed regularly when there's updates in there, including press releases and other things.
Jonathan Schiller, President and CEO of Garnet Health. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Patricio. My pleasure.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Robayo for Radio Catskill.
And we reached out to Assemblywoman Aileen Gunther of New York's 100th for her reaction. The lawmaker is a registered nurse who worked at Catskill Regional Medical Center, the former name for Garnet, years ago.
Well, first and foremost, you know that I worked at the hospital in our community for a very, very long time. The other thing I always think about is the health, how our health demographics are. And, you know, we're not doing very well. And so any kind of closures, I hope, will not impact our community because they need medical care. And so I saw that the infectious disease doctor in Garnet, it won't be there. The palliative care, which is important for people that are suffering with cancer or other diseases, and you know, anything with the long-term care, et cetera, is also out. And I think that there's a financial issue, which, you know, Jonathan Schiller said, but right now I feel like they're expanding our community. We're having a lot of people moving up, building houses, building complex. And I think that it's going to be very difficult for many people to go down to the Middletown campus because of the fact many people don't have transportation. Buses are very expensive. You know, we have few and far between. We have ambulances, but do we have enough? So I'm a little bit, you know, I have trepidation about it. And, you know, I really feel that, you know, we should do as much as we can to keep our communities healthy. And as we expand, you know, we're going to need more services. And I don't, you know, that's all I can say. I know that there's a financial issue. I know that they built a very large hospital. The last time I was in Orange County, there was actually people in the area where the ambulances were supposed to be parked. So it seemed like it was overcrowded at that moment in time. But I don't know what it looks like now. But again, our population is growing, and I'm a little bit frightened.
Your constituents, some of them seem to be frightened about, you know, the possibility of Garnet Medical Center, Catskills, Harris Campus, possibly closing. There's some folks that are afraid of that. What do you say to those fears?
Well, I think that they are fearful, and I guess we're all a little fearful about any kind of a closure. I know that, you know, their ambition at this point is to build a different hospital and let go of the one that they have because they said they don't utilize the entire hospital. So we'll have to see in the future. And of course, you know, when you're 60 and above, and you have an emergent situation, you want a hospital to be close by, and you want to have the services necessary to keep people alive. So, you know, in the summertime, we have people, you know, on the river. We have people that come to our communities. They're renting houses, Airbnbs. So, you know, the population is growing during the summer months. And the hope is that the emergency care area in Catskill Regional will be able to address all of these issues. And, you know, we have to see as we go forward. You know, I know that our population is growing. I know it is. And I know that, you know, if we eliminate some of the care, it means that the health care of our community is somewhat in jeopardy. And I know that there's an issue with money. But, you know, I mean, we're not responsible for, you know, an issue with money. But, you know, when we have a community hospital, we want to make sure that it serves the community. And it's a little, it's frightening. And I'm sure other people are kind of disappointed that this is happening.
Aileen Gunther, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, everybody say a prayer.
Thank you to Jason Dole for that report. We'll take a break, and when we come back, New York passed a provision that required all New York school districts to replace their gas and diesel buses with electric school buses by 2035. That's about 50,000 school buses owned by around 1,000 school districts. We'll learn how one local school district is making the switch. Next, this is Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
On the next Radio Lab.
I wanted to conquer the diseases of children.
The story of a man who completely altered the course of human health.
His work is estimated to have saved about 8 million lives a year.
One single scientist responsible for over 40 vaccines.
Chickenpox, adenovirus, measles, mumps, rubella, Japanese encephalitis.
Who you'd think would be a household name.
Among a group of pediatricians who give his vaccines, no one heard of him. No one.
That's on the next Radio Lab.
This afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. Last year, New York State passed an ambitious mandate. By 2027, all school districts can only purchase zero-emission buses. And by 2035, all operating school buses must be zero-emission. That is, powered only by electricity rather than diesel or gas. It's an ambitious target aligned with New York's equally ambitious climate goals. It's also heard a lot of pushback and criticism from school districts and New York Republican lawmakers for being unrealistic and, quote, one size fits all. Their campaign to delay or repeal the mandate is called Pump the Brakes. Radio Catskill reporter Chia Tien Nicole Chen spoke to Matthew Evans, the superintendent of Monticello Central School District, to see how they're approaching the transition to electric buses locally.
Monticello Central School District got its first electric school bus this March with federal grant money from the Environmental Protection Agency's Clean School Bus Program. As a rural district, Monticello was prioritized for these funds. Their superintendent, Matthew Evans, described the process to me.
In spring of 2022, there were some grants that came out from the Environmental Protection Agency on grants for school districts to acquire electric school buses. And through a partnership with Leonard Bus Sales and Cornice Technology, those are vendors that we purchase our buses from Leonard Bus Sales. We wrote a grant for one electric bus vehicle and a charger for it.
Monticello received the grant in October that year, $375,000 for one new electric school bus and $20,000 for a charger. But to make the bus functional for its needs, Monticello put in a lot of preparation and some additional money from its general fund.
So the total that we received in that grant was $395,000, and that enabled us to buy one bus at the cost of $375,000, and the remaining $20,000 was for a charger. Now, we've supplemented that money for the charger for a faster charger that allows us to charge the vehicle quicker. But what also wasn't included in that was kind of the infrastructure needed to set up the charging station and so forth. So that's, it's fairly intuitive to think that, but you know, it's kind of something that, you know, we won the grant, where's the electric bus? Well, the vendor's not going to bring you an electric bus unless you have a place to actually charge it. So we worked with NYSEG, we worked with Leonard Bus Sales, we worked with our architect during that transition time. Once the charging station was fully operational and installed, then Leonard Bus Sales readied the bus and brought it out to us. So that took about a year and a half.
It's been almost 3 months since the bus first arrived, and Monticello's transportation team has been testing it out.
We've been using it on some different runs, and so far only the administrators in our transportation department have been driving it either to special events or on particular runs. And the reason for that is they're still kind of collecting data on it. How's the temperature in the bus? How far can they go with it before it needs to be recharged? and really trying it out on kind of every run possible before we start working it into some regular rotation. The administration of the transportation department would be driving it anyway because of the shortage of drivers and wanting to really get a good feel for how far and how long and how does it handle and what they need to know before they impart that information to our drivers and mechanics. But it seems to be going well. It seems to get to and from their destinations on time and without issue. The charging station is working very well. It's operating great. But it's a new vehicle, so one would expect a three-month-old vehicle to operate great.
It's also one thing to have one electric school bus in your fleet and a whole other thing to have an entire fleet of electric buses.
Right now, everything's good. It's just a matter of how do we bring it to scale? How do we afford bringing it to scale? And how will the grid support that scale as well? You know, we have more than 50 buses at our station during the day, you know, in between runs. Certainly plugging them in either midday or overnight is going to put a strain on the existing grid, not only the energy that's being put fueled directly to our bus garage, but also the line in general. I think we're still in the imagination stage of that. You know, we are planning, we are talking about it. We're working with contractors around that issue. But there's still a lot of questions about how that's all going to work. We find it challenging, but I can't tell you that it's impossible either.
Aside from logistics, chief on everybody's minds is the question of funding. Funding for new electric school buses, chargers, and all of the associated infrastructure. Evan says that Monticello Central School District works with Leonard Bus Sales on their grant applications. They're working on applying for funding from the state's New York School Bus Incentive Program. This past winter, they did apply for more federal funding from the EPA, but did not receive it.
These grants come out, everybody's applying for them, and they're extremely competitive.
Recently, several state lawmakers have pushed for extensions on the 2035 electrification deadline. In multiple school districts throughout New York, voters rejected including the purchase of electric buses in the school budget. In Monticello, electric school buses were not part of this year's budget vote. I asked Evans how his district is thinking about funding the transition to electric buses.
Relative to this past budget season, there was a pretty significant advocacy push in Albany for extensions or other allowances within those deadlines that the governor and the state put forward several years ago, right? So I think there was still a sense of optimism that, you know, those things might get pushed back. Now, they haven't yet. That's not to say they won't, but, you know, as we sit today, they haven't been moved back. And we also are still very much pursuing state and federal grant opportunities. So these are things that, you know, we're going to start rolling in possibly as soon as next year's budget, but we're still pretty far away from that decision. And remember, we still have, in essence, we're not really limited to electric vehicle purchases until 2027. So there's still time to, you know, kind of wait and see how the infrastructure plays out, or to see if those dates get moved back, or to see if there are more state and federal funding opportunities before we, you know, really start purchasing new buses. I would like to think that these mandates are coming from a good place to reduce carbon emissions and curtail climate change, right, as a public policy. And I would hope that lawmakers and elected officials are earmarking funds for school districts and bus companies to make this transition. Even if all of that is true, I still don't know enough yet about whether all the other pieces are going to be ready on time. You know, there's still, I think, open questions about the capacity that we have in our grid to make this switch happen in the timelines that are set. You know, I think it's good that those dates are out there and it gives something people to shoot for, but I don't know that, I think to me it's still an unsettled question about whether we'll get there on time.
From Liberty, Jatia Nicole Chen for Radio Catskill.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, growing older together. We'll hear from Tommy Cambridge, Executive Director, right after a break. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. farmartscollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hello, I'm Thane Peterson, host of Living Jazz. You know, jazz is a great improvised art form that started in America, spread around the world, and is still going strong. That's why every Saturday afternoon I bring you the best in current jazz. It's the newest, most interesting music you can hear anywhere. Join me for Living Jazz, noon to 2 Saturday, here on Radio Catskill.
People talk about polarization, but did you know most of us are in the hopeful majority, tired of political divisions and looking for a way out? That's why Radio Catskill and StoryCorps invite you to have a conversation with someone different and not so different than you. It's one small step where strangers get to know each other as people. Help bridge the divide, one conversation at a time. Sign up at WJFFradio.org.
StoryCorps is one small step, and the radio station helps are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Growing Older Together's mission is to provide residents age 60 and older in Wayne County and Western Sullivan County and adjacent areas both the practical means and social connections to live independently in their own homes. This morning, we're checking in with Tommy Cambridge, Executive Director of Growing Older Together, about what's going on. How are you?
Tim, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Let's remind people, I mean, I did a little kind of, you know, synopsis there about your mission, but you really are providing this service, which I mean, some people may not know about, which is why we want you to be here to kind of get this word out even more to folks in the area about what you do. Can you explain a little bit more about some of the services you provide for folks?
I will. Thank you. So Growing Older Together, we call it GOT for short. It is not Game of Thrones, although that was around before us. But in the area, we like to think we're more important than a TV show. We're a grassroots, nonprofit, all-volunteer organization comprised of members. These are the people we serve. They are seniors in Western Sullivan and Wayne County, as you said, 60 years and up. And then our volunteers who provide the support to those folks so that they may maintain their independence, age in place, in the homes of their choice. And aging in place doesn't mean remaining in place. It means thriving where you want to live and avoiding or at least deferring a move to somewhere else, like an assisted living environment or a nursing home. In our region, we don't exactly have a plethora of quality arrangements like that.
Well, and I think that that's also good for folks to know that this is this service, this organization exists because of that rural nature of our area. You wouldn't think that something like this might be available. You might think that, oh, well, if you reach a certain point, you're going to have to go off to somewhere, another county, out of state, whatever. But you guys are here to help provide that opportunity for folks to age in place.
That's true. We basically fill the gap. So things that our members used to be able to do and can't anymore or shouldn't, and that includes driving themselves places. That is our biggest service that we offer, is private transportation. So all of our volunteers are vetted for a clean driving record, valid driver's license, as well as a criminal background. And we'll take our members to the doctor to pick up groceries, to visit their grandkids. But we also do things like technical support. Now, everybody could use that, but seniors particularly can be challenged with things like mobile phones or setting email up or even a troublesome TV remote control. I don't watch TV because I can't figure out my remote control. But also things, just home tasks, getting up on ladders, things that
you shouldn't be a doing. Little bit,
exactly. Yeah. You know, either you can't or you shouldn't be doing at this point. But also the social calls. As you mentioned, when we live in the rural area that we do, this beautiful countryside, there's a lot of isolation, particularly for seniors. Some of it is chosen, but often it's not. And our seniors do not have to live at the end of a 2-mile driveway. They can really just be 50 feet down the road. But to them, it could be 2 miles because they have mobility issues. So we do social calls where we come in and chat with them, read a book together, have a cup of tea, sometimes just listen. Seems to be a vanishing skill. So those are our primary services.
One of the things I love about your vision statement is that you say you offer individuals the opportunity to share in the wisdom and knowledge that age brings. You're honoring these folks and their wisdom. You mentioned some of the activities you have to do that, but what are other ways that you are able to do that?
We partner with another nonprofit based in Narrowsburg. It's called Tustin Social. And that was born out of a seminar that was done 2 years ago where we brought in seniors from the area to find out what's missing in the community. And one of the biggest things was this opportunity to come together and to share stories, just to socialize. And so we came up with the Sage Sessions. And that's something that happens the first and third Thursdays of every month. It's open to all seniors in the area, not just GOT members. And we have programs. Sometimes it's comedy shows. Sometimes it's foraging for nature. Sometimes it is things that are interesting to seniors, like will planning, estate planning, and that sort of stuff. We always try to do something that will engage. And in the past year that we have had this going, we have grown considerably. We have a great interest in the community, and we're always looking to bring more people on.
And you are, as you mentioned, a nonprofit, so you're gearing up for your big fundraiser, which is Lava Palooza. I know you had the first one last year. Explain to folks what Lava Palooza is.
Yes, well, last year, Lava Palooza was called that because we had it in a beautiful meadow in Lava, New York. This is our, and that we were quite successful. We raised not only a good amount of money to support our marketing campaigns for the coming year, but also to raise awareness. Like you said earlier, we're kind of the county's best kept secret, and that's not what we want to be. Mm-hmm. We want people to know that we're out there and we can help them. So this is the second annual Lava Palooza. It's being held this year at the 2nd District Brew Farm, which is near Tyler Hill, Pennsylvania, basically just across the Delaware River. It's a 1950s rockabilly style carnival and picnic fundraiser to raise awareness and some money for Growing Older Together. The place is a stunning hilltop in Pennsylvania. It's under a big tent, and we have great food, a midway with games, live music from a band called Laura Hope and the Arctones out of Kingston. They are a rockabilly band, and they're quite the tortures. And we're looking to appeal to the whole community, so youth, families, and seniors. We want to attract a younger generation of volunteers, and we are making this an annual event that must be on everybody's community calendar. And for the price of $45, children 10 and under are free. It's all inclusive. So all the food, the non-alcoholic beverages, the music, the dancing, the fun, everything is included in one price.
Well, and you're supporting this mission, too. You're supporting these wonderful people in our community that are able to stay in their own homes and support the work that you do for them. If you're supported by a lot of volunteers as well.
About 75 of them.
Yeah. So if I want to talk about if someone's listening and doesn't know about your service and, you know, is 60 plus but wants to know more, how can they learn more? But then also, if someone wants to volunteer their services, how can they learn more?
It would be.
And what do you need? You need what types of volunteers?
Thank you. Sorry. Yeah, it's the same way. So whether you are looking to be a member or a volunteer, and we have people who are both. You can either go to our website, which is www.growingoldertogether.org, or you can call our hotline, which has an answering machine at all times. It is manned Monday through Friday, 9 to 4. That number is 570-630-0509, and we have wonderful call managers who will answer any questions, can provide membership forms or volunteer forms. And we're looking not only for volunteers who support our seniors, and they go through a vetting process, as I mentioned. The only requirement is you have to be at least 18 years old, and then you have to pass the background checks with valid driver's license and that sort of thing. But otherwise, we have no discrimination.
And are there particular areas of volunteers that you're looking for, particular specialties or expertise?
Just the areas that I mentioned. So as long as you can drive. If you have technical troubleshooting skills, we can always use that. If you're a good conversationalist, then you'd be perfect for social calls. And if you can get on a ladder, then you're ours. We would love to have you. We're also looking for volunteers for the Lava Palooza, and that does not require vetting or any special skills. We need people to man our admission tents, the auction booths, parking lot, that sort of thing. And we'll train everybody. And it's the same number you would call if that's something you'd be interested in helping us out with.
There's also business opportunities as well for sponsorship or
yes,
support.
Thank you. Yeah, since we are a nonprofit, we fund ourselves through corporate sponsorships, private donations, grants, as well as our membership. Our members pay a small fee every year, $150 a year, which gives them up to 100 services a year. So it really is pennies a day. But for folks who might be challenged with that, we have sponsorship opportunities, but we're always looking for corporate sponsors, either donations for our auction for Lollapalooza or cash is also king. And again, you'd call the same number. You'd probably get transferred to me, and then I would walk anyone who's interested through how you can help us out there.
What's one of the biggest requests you get from folks for support or services?
The biggest is by far transportation, and it's because we are a rural village. We belong to something called the Village to Village Network. There are over 300 villages in the United States. Most of them are in metropolitan areas. So for us, being a rural village, and we're one of the few in that network, it's geographically dispersed. So transportation is by far the biggest service that we get requests for. And right. We can do it. We have fantastic volunteers with nice cars, clean cars.
All right. Tommy Cambridge is the executive director of Growing Older Together. Thank you for the support that you're offering our seniors in the area. It's a great service.
Thank you, Tim.
All right. We'll take a break. And when we come back, after a six-year hiatus, BioBlitz returning to Northeast Pennsylvania for 24 hours of species spotting. What does that mean? Well, we'll tell you next.
I'm Maria Ino USA. As immigration and the border take center stage in this campaign season, we're going to take you to Sasabe, Mexico, a town in the shadows of the border wall where the locals have been forced to flee because of cartel violence.
We are in a war. There's gunshots all over these mountains. We don't know what's happening.
This week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Juana Summers. We've got your back when it comes to reporting the news. And one of the things this station counts on to keep it all going, contributions.
Including that vehicle you no longer need. Donate it. Help us bring you the news you count on. Learn more by visiting this station's website. And thanks.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The 2024 Upper Delaware BioBlitz is this weekend at the Highlights Foundation Retreat Center in Boyd's Mills. That's in Wayne County. Eight teams of scientists and amateur naturalists will gather to begin their collection of every unique species of plant, animal, fungus that they can find in 24 hours. Some teams, like the mammal team looking for bats and the insect team looking for night-flying insects, will work through the night. The public can meet scientists from different disciplines, see what they have collected, and take a tour of the site to learn how different species live and thrive in the context of the overall property. Radio Catskill's Joe Johnson spoke to Steve Schwartz, BioBlitz organizer, about the event's return to the area.
Welcome, Steve.
Hi, Joe. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. Explain to me exactly what a BioBlitz is.
So a BioBlitz is an event where teams of scientists, in our case eight teams, totaling about 40 scientists and amateur naturalists covering all forms of life, get together for 24 hours on a property to collect, identify, and catalog every single living species they can find visible to the naked eye. The teams range from mammals to herpetology to botany to bryology, which is mosses and ferns and lichens, to fish and bugs and birds.
So you're basically looking to identify and catalog every different organism, every different species you can find on the property.
Yes. So this will be our sixth BioBlitz. We started in 2013. We did four public events in 14, 16, and 18. And then the pandemic came along. So we did a virtual event in 21 on a property where each team was able to go in for any 24-hour period during the season to do their work. And then we compiled it. We never had a public event other than a public Zoom session where we talked about the event. So we're very excited. This is the first public event since 2018.
Any big surprises in these previous events?
Well, you know, we're not going to find anything unknown to science. but we are going to find things that are unknown to science in this region. And that is one of the key reasons we do a BioBlitz. A lot of field work is done around here, but some of it ends up in a drawer or is never published publicly. And one of the things that we focused on in past BioBlitzes is something called first occurrences. So first occurrence is the first time that a species has been publicly documented. And in previous BioBlitzes, we found, each year we found between 40 and 60 first occurrences. Depends on who's on the teams and what their specialty is, but mosses and plants and even bugs have had first occurrences in the past.
So these are organisms that are known to science but have never been identified in this particular area.
Right. That's one of the areas that we focus on, is broadening the data set. And one of the reasons we do that is that every county in Pennsylvania has something called a natural heritage area inventory, which documents biodiversity and critical habitats and areas that should be considered for conservation, and areas where you might not want to do some form of development or do it during some kind of cycle. And the oldest natural heritage inventory in the state is in Wayne County. So one of the goals of the BioBlitz has been to try to start documenting some of these things that have not been documented since 1991, and to encourage the people of Wayne County to get together to update the natural heritage area inventory. And we're now having those discussions, and hopefully we'll see that in the future.
One of the questions I had was, why a 24-hour period? What is particular about that?
Well, part of that is that, you know, it's the game. There's a bit of competition between the teams to see who can collect the most species and identify them. It always comes down to the bugs and the plants. And in some years, the bugs do better, and some years, the plants do better. I think in the 2013 BioBlitz, bugs, which was a particularly strong team, found 457 unique species in 24 hours. 24-hour period also indicates the diurnal nature of life. There are some species that come out at night and some species that come out in the morning and some during the day. So we try to follow the entire cycle during a day. Now, we pick a period to do this BioBlitz, which is usually the last week of June, because it's a convenient period. The weather is typically good. It's after schools are over. It's before camps have started. People have some time on their schedule. And, you know, it works for us, but not all the teams are happy. The mushrooms are usually unhappy because they'd love to do the BioBlitz in late summer, early fall, when most mushrooms will fruit. The birds would love to do it in April during the annual migration northward. But, you know, the plants are happy, the bugs are happy, and we just try to find the best time for everybody.
I'm wondering, with the rain we've had over the last couple of days, if that'll help your mycologists to be happy this year.
I know they are dancing. Because it can be dry, and they look for the smallest little crust or slime mold, and they will be happy to find some newly fruited mushrooms.
Now, is this going to be an ongoing project? Will it be more BioBlitzes in the future?
Well, like I said, this is the sixth, and it's run by a ad hoc steering committee, and basically people that have been on it since we decided to do it back in 2012. And we originally thought we'd do it every year. That's very ambitious. So we try to do it every other year. And, you know, we'll get together sometime next year and say, should we do it in 26, and make a decision at that time.
Finding a piece of property must be a challenge as well.
It is, but there are lots of great properties in this region. We've done them on, we've done bioblitzes on both sides of the river. We'd love to do the next one in New York. And if anybody has any ideas on properties that would be interested in hosting the bioblitz that exhibit a lot of biodiversity, we'd be happy to consider them.
Now, how do you identify an organism? Let's say you find an insect, for example. How do you identify that down to the species level?
There are several ways. First off, we have a world-class bug team this year, headed up by Tanya Dapke, who's the head of collections at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. They have collections of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of bugs that they can always refer back to. And some of the bugs might end up back in their collection because they will be specimens that they don't have or they don't have variations of. It depends on the bug, and some bugs have to be identified at the microscopic level. And so they'll have on site, you know, stereo microscopes, dissecting microscopes, so they can get down to the number of segments on the hind leg of a bug. Some of them might be so hard to identify that they'll end up at another institution. So in the past, we've had bugs end up with specialists at the Museum of Natural History or the Smithsonian or Academy of Natural Sciences, because a lot of field scientists will specialize in one particular species or one particular genus and will have expertise in differentiating between the species. And then another way we're doing for the first time this year, both the mushroom team and the bug team are interested in doing some DNA work. So the bug team is going to be doing eDNA. And eDNA is a process whereby you can take a sample of water or soil or air, and depending on what types of, let's call them reagents, you have access to, and depending on your budget, you can identify all of the creatures that have left their DNA in that place. So in a stream, every creature in the stream is like sloughing off skin or cells, and that comes floating down, and that'll be collected. And after the analysis, they'll be able to say that that creature was in the stream upstream of where they sampled. The mushroom team is going to be doing some DNA work because mushroom taxonomies are very dynamic. They're changing all the time now, mm-hmm. thanks to DNA. And sometimes there's confusion between the morphological characteristics, how they look, and what they are. So they've asked to do some DNA testing with some of their samples that need further analysis.
Tell me about the public part of the BioBlitz.
Yeah, so it starts Friday the 28th with the scientists showing up to start their work at noon, and they continue their work until noon on Saturday the 29th. On Saturday the 29th, the public is invited to come and meet the scientists, see what they've collected, go on walks and talks, and, you know, learn about more about nature and biodiversity. So public is invited from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. On Saturday. And our model is that we really want to introduce kids to science in process, that science is long, hard, dirty, good work, and that the field scientists that we know that have come to these events have been doing it for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, and that really, that their quest is not to find answers as much as to come up with new questions. So they want to be out in the field to continue to look for things that they haven't discovered or known about before. And the way you do that is really getting out there. And one of the advantages of BioBlitz is that scientists on the bug team will be out there with scientists on the plant team. And maybe they will, the plant people might report back that they saw some bug on the plant that the scientists never saw. And maybe they'll come up with some kind of new association between those bugs and plants because they're working together. So, you know, part of the goal is to introduce kids to science in the field, but also we have all kinds of other things going on. So, you know, some kids best relate to science through writing or drawing or theater or music, and we'll have all of those things happening during the course of the BioBlitz.
And that's at the Highlights Foundation Retreat Center in Boyd Mills, Pennsylvania, I believe.
Yes. It's about halfway between Narrowsburg and Honesdale. It's a beautiful property. The total property is about 1,300 acres. It includes wetlands and lowlands and running water, streams, hemlock forests, deciduous forests, cliffs, and open meadows. And so the scientists chose the site from the sites that were nominated because they think it has great biodiversity. The BioBlitz can't happen without a lot of volunteers and sponsors, and it costs money, you know. And the BioBlitz, the scientists have often said that they've been to many like events like this, but they've never been offered more than a hot dog. So we have great food catered by the Highlights Foundation culinary team, headed by Amanda Richards, who's been involved in pretty much all the past BioBlitzes with Marcia Dunsmore. It takes a lot of funding to get this event up and running. Big sponsors this year, in addition to Highlights, are the Wayne County Community Foundation, which has really helped us connect with a lot of people. The Ohm Foundation, a Wayne County-based family foundation, the Pocono Forest and Waters Collaborative, which is a program of the Pennsylvania Environmental Council and the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, and the Upper Delaware Council, the Wayne County Conservation District, the Friends of the Upper Delaware River, and some local businesses have contributed, as well as a lot of individuals.
I've been speaking with Steve Schwartz, organizer of this year's BioBlitz event in Boyd Mills, Pennsylvania, this weekend.
Come on out. You can poke and look and maybe even handle a few things and go out onto the property with the scientists to learn how they see and what they do when they're out there doing their work.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Joe.
And thanks to Radio Catskills' Joe Johnson for that report. Before we go, in our previous segment, we were speaking to Executive Director Tommy Cambridge of Growing Older Together about their second annual Lava Palooza. We forgot to tell you the date. It's coming up Saturday, August 3rd. The rain date is Sunday, August 4th. That's at the 2nd District Brew Farm in Milanville. And before we go, also reminding you about One Small Step. That is our partnership with StoryCorps here at Radio Catskill, an effort to remind people of the humanity in all of us, even those with whom we disagree. The initiative brings strangers with different views together to record a conversation, not to debate politics, but to learn who we are as people. And the audio recordings of each interview are archived at the Library of Congress. You can find out more about this initiative and how you could be a part of it at our website, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Radio Catskill supporters include SUNY Sullivan, a community college in the Sullivan Catskills focused on preparing students for the future. More information at sunysullivan.edu. Livingston Manor, dining, shopping, and the arts at the gateway to the Catskill Park. LivingstonManorNY.com. And listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hi, it's Rosie Starr, host of Farm and Country. Join us Saturdays at 10 a.m. on Radio Catskill for stories about rural life in the Catskills and the Delaware River Valley. Feed your ears some good radio produce. Listen local.
Mm-hmm. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, independent grassroots global news. Our reporting includes breaking daily news headlines and in-depth interviews with people on the front lines of the world's most pressing issues. People speaking for themselves, providing unique and sometimes provocative perspectives on global events. Democracy Now!, weekdays at noon, right here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, sunny, very warm and humid. A couple of showers and a heavy thunderstorm possible late this afternoon. Some of those thunderstorms could bring hail and damaging winds. Also keeping an eye on a couple of heavy thunderstorms that might move through the area this evening. Otherwise, cloudy, low 61. Tomorrow should be pretty nice. Sunny, less humid, high 77. It's 11 o'clock.